If it please the court, Malcolm Mead, Paul Evans for the defendants appellants. We are here pursuant to the interlocutory appeal provisions of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. The CGIA permits an immediate appeal from the denial of motion to dismiss because public entities should not be dragged through the time and expense of discovery and trial, or to learn at the end of trial that the claim was barred all along by the CGIA. The record contains five key documents: the complaint, two trust agreements, motion to dismiss, and plaintiff's response. But that record is sufficient for this court to resolve the question of immunity because the duties which plaintiffs claim the defendants breached, if they exist, arise from a source other than the trust agreements. They are therefore independent duties, the breach of which sound in tort and not contract. Because they sound in tort, they are barred by the CGIA.
Just so I'm clear on this, your position that as a result, as a consequence, the entire action goes away, that the claim, the entire case must be dismissed against all defendants?
Correct. Yes, against all defendants, yes, Your Honor.
And all claims?
And all claims, yes.
Even if some claims could not be, or could not lie in tort, is there a distinction between specific claims within the complaint filed by the
I believe all the claims they asserted could lie in tort. Therefore, all the claims are barred by the CGIA.
Okay. But how do their claims, I guess I should let you go ahead with your argument, but how do their claims based on your unilateral and mutual mistake lie in tort? How would that be analyzed so that those either lie or could lie in tort?
Your Honor, I don't recall seeing in the complaint a claim, anything based upon unilateral or mutual mistake. However, you could read the complaint as alleging fraud in the inducement. We have two trusts involved, the disability trust and what we call the Chiba trust, the one that had the long name that you used. Mesa State was a member of both trust agreements. The allegation is that as you moved from the disability trust to the Chiba trust, somebody inserted provisions which allowed for forfeiture or waiver of rights, according to the plaintiffs. And the Mesa State, or the plaintiffs say that Mesa State and the employees were not told about these provisions. They kind of went along, and then Mesa State withdrew, and then found out, oh, here's these provisions that say the opposite of what they say, that say there's no refund of money once in. And so it's a fraud in the inducement, and fraud in the inducement is a tort.
Yes, I should back up a little bit. I agree with you. There's no specific unilateral or mutual mistake claim in the complaint. I misspoke there. But I believe the plaintiffs argued that in their briefs, that they had a claim, if you took what they were stating as facts and their allegations, that they had a claim of unilateral or mutual mistake, or you could read that to be one of unilateral or mutual mistake, because they were mistaken about what they were entering into.
Well, I would say that under the CGIA, to quote the Supreme Court from Robinson versus State Lottery Commission, it doesn't matter what they did argue, what matters is what they could argue. They could be arguing fraud in the inducement. It could be a tort, therefore the whole thing is barred by the CGIA. They can throw labels around, they can use contract terms all they want, but this court is required to strip off the legal terminology and look at the substance of the factual allegations underlying the complaint. Excuse me, sir.
Mr. Mead, after you have your...
Let's go ahead.
I'm sorry I was rude. I apologize. You began by saying that what we need to do here is look at the source of the duty. Would you agree that there is language in these contracts that could be read to create duty?
The trust agreements contain many duties. The question is, do they allege a breach of the duties stated in the trust agreements?
Or let us use as an example the fiduciary relationship issue.
Okay.
The trust committee has... there's language in the documents that says that the trust committee shall act with the care, skill, prudence, diligence, etc. Would you agree that that's there?
Correct.
Now, I understand that there is also there can be a tort for breach of fiduciary duty. But in this case, isn't the first place we look for where the duty is, look to the contract? And if the contract establishes a duty like this, isn't that what we should focus on as opposed to the theoretical existence of a breach of fiduciary duty claim?
If I could answer Your Honor's question by backing up a step to your first comments, you said we look to the source of the duty when resolving a CGIA issue. I say that that's a good starting point, but before you can look to the source of the duty, you have to identify the duty allegedly breached. The trust agreement does contain a provision saying the trustee shall act with care and skill, some language to that effect, but they never alleged a breach of it. The complaint has no claim that the trustees failed to act with care and skill. The factual allegations underlying the complaint are that Mason State and its employees are members of the trust. They contribute to the reserve fund in the trust. Then Mason State withdraws and requests a refund. The defendants deny the request for a refund, and then the plaintiffs say, well, where's our money? What's going on? The question is, where's the duty to provide a refund? Their entire case rests on the theory or underlying allegation that the defendants had a duty to refund contributions made by Mesa State and its employees to the reserve fund after Mesa State withdrew. They never say that the trustees breached the duty to exercise care and skill. That duty is not the basis of the action. Because it's not the basis of the action, the court need not consider it and should not consider it. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Under the economic loss rule, a duty is independent if it arises from a source other than the contract and is not stated in the contract. Under the CGIA, when a duty breached does not arise from the terms of a contract, the claim could lie in tort and is subject to the CGIA. When you apply that test here, you will see that the duty underlying their complaint, this duty of the duty to make a refund of contributions made to the reserve fund, is an independent duty. The record contains complete copies of the trust agreements. When you read those agreements, you will see that nothing in them imposes on the defendants a duty to refund contributions made by Mesa State and its employees to the reserve fund after Mesa State withdraws. Therefore, if this duty exists, it necessarily arises from a source other than the trust agreements. Because it is not stated in the trust agreements, it's an independent duty, the breach of which gives rise to claims sounding in tort and not contract.
Excuse me, Mr. Mead. Did not the plaintiffs allege that there was a duty under the trust agreements that the trust committee not discriminate among the college employees? And the way I understand it or read their complaint, they are arguing or complaining that by not refunding the trust reserve funds or the portion of the trust reserve funds that they contributed, that would result in discriminatory treatment between them and the other remaining college employees who are members of the trust. How do you respond to that argument that the trustees have breached their duty not to be discriminatory?
I would answer that by saying it all rests upon and goes back to the underlying theory of a duty to make a refund. The theory of disequal treatment is that after Mesa State requests the refund, defendants deny the refund. Now the employees of the defendant colleges have access to the reserve fund. The employees of Mesa State don't, so you have disequal treatment. Well, it rests upon the theory of a duty to make a refund. The whole thing goes back to the duty to make a refund. Where does that duty come from, is my point. Where does the duty to make a refund come from? It doesn't come from the trust agreements. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Thank you.
Okay, sorry.
Mr. Mead, while you're moving on, I just want to clarify something you said. I understand that your position is there is no duty in the contract as pertinent here, and thus anything else, if the duty comes from a separate place, it's economic, you know, we don't have application of the economic loss rule. But I want to make sure that you agree with this statement. If the duty does arise in the contract, then the economic loss rule would allow the case to go forward even in a CGIA case, right?
I do agree with that.
Right. All right. Thank you.
If the duty arises under the terms of legal trust agreements, you have a contract claim. The problem they have is that the duties that they alleged that we breached are not stated in the trust agreements. If those duties exist, they come from a source other than the trust agreements and are therefore independent duties, the breach of it gives rise to claim standing in tort and not contract. Going back to Your Honor's question about the duty to treat beneficiaries equally, I don't think you'll find a statement in the trust agreements that imposes that duty expressly. I agree that trustees, as fiduciaries, have a duty to treat beneficiaries equally, but that duty, again, comes from a source outside the trust agreements. It's therefore an independent duty, the breach of which gives rise to claim standing in tort, not contract. There is a provision at the very end of the Chiba Trust which talks about discriminatory treatment, but it pertains to the application of benefit programs or benefit plans. This case has no claim about a benefit program or benefit plan. Nobody is saying, as a plaintiff, I retired, I was disabled, I went to a doctor, my medical bills weren't paid. That kind of claim is just not in this case. This whole case is about, should we refund assets in the reserve fund to a college after the college withdraws from the trust agreements? So the provision about discriminatory treatment, which I think they rely upon to some extent, doesn't apply to the facts of this case.
Well, plaintiffs are also claiming that defendants failed to perform their contractual obligations owed to plaintiffs, including contractually imposed fiduciary duties and duties of good faith and fair dealing, by depriving plaintiff of benefits of the trust reserve fund to which they contributed. Is that not a duty arising under the contract?
The contract does state that the trustees shall act as fiduciaries. It says they have the powers under the Fiduciary Powers Act. It doesn't say that they shall act as fiduciaries or have fiduciary duties. But I'd say more importantly, what is the specific fiduciary duty they say is breached? Fiduciary duty is very broad. What is the specific fiduciary duty they say is breached? Again, it goes back to make a refund from the reserve fund. Where in the trust agreements does it say make a refund from the reserve fund? It doesn't.
Would you briefly address John Plains?
Okay. The entire case is before this court. The entire case rests on two documents, the trust agreements. For an inverse condemnation claim to survive, the defendant trustees have to have the power of eminent domain. It's either in the trust agreements or it's not. The evidence is entirely documentary before this court. In the interest of judicial economy, resolve that claim. It would not serve any purpose to remand this case back to the probate court on the inverse condemnation claim to ask the probate judge to read the trust agreements and tell us if they can contain the power of eminent domain. The evidence is documentary. The only evidence is the trust agreements. It's all right here.
However, Mr. Mead, the only question before us is whether or not there's jurisdiction under the CGIA, correct?
Correct.
Now, or whether that claim is barred by the CGIA.
Correct. And again, it sounds in tort, so it's just, the language they used shows exactly that their claims are for the misappropriation or conversion of funds. They say we took their funds. Taking is a tort. It's conversion. It's misappropriation. It's a tort under the CGIA. It's barred. I'll reserve my 55 seconds.
Good afternoon. Joseph Coleman, registration number 6856. The first thing, Judge Hawthorne, I assume you might have been able to look. The complaint does have that mutual mistake and unilateral mistake, paragraph 61 of the complaint.
Yeah, I thought it did, but I couldn't remember for sure, and I knew it was I knew it was either there or in the brief, one of the two.
Well, I prefer to have it in the complaint. It's a little stronger than being in the brief and appellate level.
Well, since you're pointing that out to me and we're having a discussion, and let me, I won't have to interrupt you to ask you this question.
Okay, well, I thought I would at least compliment you on your question.
Thank you.
Let's put this a little bit into context.
I wanted to ask you a question. Because this question, I think, is very important to me, understanding this case. There were two trusts. There was a disability trust, and then the disability trust was incorporated into the CHIBA trust. That's the way I understand it. Is that correct?
Either that, or we can call it the disability trust and the amended and restated trust.
It's
basically similar trusts with very modest modifications.
Right. They both had language in them in different articles and sections that say all contributions to the trust shall be irrevocable, and under no circumstances shall any monies properly paid into the trust or any part of the trust be recoverable by or payable to the colleges or any employee. I think the only difference, that's the disability trust. The CHIBA trust, or the restated trust, says payable to the colleges or any participant rather than any employee. So my question to you is just what Mr. Mead was talking about. What specific duty, contractual duty, is there that underlies your claim that the plaintiff's employees are entitled to any recovery or payout of the portion of the trust reserve fund that they paid in?
Okay, and stated very bluntly, why am I here if I can't win in the trial court? When do we get back? The reality is, yes, that's not a difficult provision to find, but we will present evidence at trial, once we ultimately can get there, to show that there are a variety of ways of getting the remedy we want. We're not trying to ask for a refund because of a concept of you owe me a refund. What we're trying to say is this reserve should have been used pro rata for all the beneficiaries. And the way it gets to the Colorado Mesa University employees now is that the reserve needs to be transferred to the successor trustee. We do not doubt that the money cannot go directly to the college. The money cannot go directly to the employees. The money should be handled exactly as the employees were told when they started this program. And that is, if you put in money, that money will be used equally with employees of 10 other colleges for your insurance and disability. It will be expended not directly by you. It'll be expended through a trustee. And the college, Colorado Mesa, has had to locate a new trustee. The program has continued, but my clients have been deprived of the $1 million reserve that was paid either directly by them or directly for them by the Colorado Mesa University. So the remedy we're going to be asking for is an accounting. We don't want any money that other people paid in. We just want our share. And we want an order that says whatever that amount is, that is transferred to the successor trustee who now is providing the services that the original trust no longer has to provide.
Excuse me, I hate to interrupt you, but what successor trustee?
Okay.
What successor trustee are you talking about?
Let me put it in a little bit of context. As part of the recruitment of employees for any of these colleges, they were all able to say, this is a perk, this is a benefit, this is why you should select our college as your employer. But we're not going to provide the benefit directly. We are going to have a trust, in effect, established. Now, once I'll call Mesa State, or its new name, Colorado Mesa, once Mesa State withdrew, Mesa State had to have a new trust established. They established a new trust so that their contributions could go into the new trust and the employees' contributions could go into the new trust. What's missing is the $1 million that the defendants in effect, distributed to their employees, to the exclusion of the people who had contributed it. That's the point, you know, and the frustration is, I can't fight the statute that says the Governmental Immunities Act comes up right away before we can present anything. And I believe our pleadings more than adequately satisfy the pleadings requirements for any breach of contract, accounting, or declaratory judgment action. Have we put in every particularity that we're going to prove at trial? No. Your question was a good question, and that's one of the particularities. What we asserted was the existence of a contract, existence of a duty, a breach of the duty, and damages, which sets forth a legitimate breach of contract claim. The particular parameters of the remedy, which you've just inquired about, hopefully I've explained. Because if you read those clauses that you just read in the context that the employees never got direct money, it was always paid for a benefit through the trust. The trust distributes money, and there is nothing in any of the agreements that precludes the trust from distributing money to a successor trustee. When I started this case, I told Mesa State, you will not get a penny. If I were to win $1 million, you won't get one penny payable to your institution. It'll all go to the successor trustee so that my clients, all the employees of Mesa State, will know that that is there. And as a practical matter, the reason the reserve is so important is you negotiate the rates of your insurance coverage depending on how much you can self-insure within the policy. The defendants took our $1 million, got the benefits out of it, and Mesa State now had to pay a much higher rate because they couldn't self-insure on the basis of the non-existing $1 million. That's the frustration. The further frustration is that the employees have nothing to do with this. They have an employment contract, they fully performed, they were promised these benefits, and because the 10 colleges reached a disagreement, and I won't even say who's right or wrong on it, reached a disagreement. Mesa State said we should handle the reserve this way to be fair to everyone, and our contention is the majority then said, well, we've got the vote, and if we do it this way, we can keep the money for our people, and it's just too bad. Think what will happen. What if 6 or 8 more colleges realize that it's not cost-effective to stay there? Does the 10th college get to keep $7 million and go on a spending spree? It's illogical the way they construe the contract. The assigning of those benefits to the successor trustees when someone withdraws accomplishes the purposes of the contract. I have asserted throughout the complaint that all we want is pro rata treatment. They say, well, you can't quote a provision that says pro rata treatment on withdrawal. No, but I can show throughout there the spirit. If there's a shortage of fund, it's pro rata.
Excuse me, Mr.
Yes.
Coleman, right? Mr.
Yes.
Coleman. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I don't want to miss out on these questions. I don't remember exactly, but I don't recall there being anything in the complaint about a successor trustee and transfer of the funds to the successor trustee. The plaintiffs in the case are two individual employees or former employees of Mesa State. Is that correct?
Well, we haven't made it to the class certification stage.
Yes, I understand that.
Yeah. Yes. In theory, the plaintiffs ultimately will be all the employees. The declaratory judgment is where we, and the accounting is where we anticipated that a probate court would be, quite equitable in determining the proper remedy. I just am presenting to you a snapshot of what the evidence would be at trial. Have we articulated exactly what the injunctive relief or the accounting relief? No, we just asked for a full and complete declaration of rights because I just thought that was adequate for notice pleading at this stage.
Let me ask you another question, sort of a procedural question. I noticed in your briefs that you indicated that you We're joining the trust, the colleges, the trustees, the defendant colleges included, so that you you maintain that you sought to avoid uncertainty about whether a trust is an entity and can be sued, and you want to ensure that all interested parties are before the court. That brings up an issue with what we're looking at is, are you actually making claims against the defendant colleges? And are they just included and joined as accommodation parties so that you can assure that you have everybody that might be interested in the lawsuit?
Considering we've been at this since 2007, and I don't know if you, any of you had the privilege of, in effect, fighting the state, everything we did was opposed, and we finally said, look it, because they wanted to join Mesa State. I said, join Mesa State if you want. We don't care. We want to get to the merits. So yes, you are, you know, you are somewhat right that we finally said, you want to join in whomever, as long as it's not a frivolous allegation. We joined in the state college is because the state colleges in under the agreement says we can appoint a trustee, but the trustee, and I'm paraphrasing, shall fulfill a fiduciary duty to the employees and not act in the best interest of the colleges.
Are you making that same complaint against the defendant colleges then?
Well, we believe the evidence will show that the defendant colleges looked at their bottom line. They went on premium holidays as soon as Mesa State got out of the out of this, trying to use up this reserve for their benefit and for the benefit of their employees. Is that right? No, I don't think that's right. I think it's a breach of their duty. And, you know, to the extent that they acted wrongfully, I believe, in a contract duty situation. If they establish that they have no contract relationship to this, they're out. Not because of government immunity, but because I lost my contract. I sued the wrong party. Governmental immunity just doesn't apply because the economic loss rule is so clear.
So, while we're on the subject of the parties, you don't dispute, do you, that the trust itself is a public entity within the meaning of 2410.103.5?
I would believe the trust would be a public entity.
And you've answered my question about defendant colleges. Thank you.
And I approached this oral argument with all sorts of economic loss rule authority, but it's obvious that I've never seen so many decisions on that. And, you know, if you want to find recent Colorado case law, this court has written many of them explaining that, and I think they're all consistent and they all support our position. If it wasn't for the contract and the what I'll call the interwoven contracts, the employment contract here is interwoven with the trust contract. If it wasn't for that, and if it wasn't for our client's third-party beneficiary status, they wouldn't have any, there's no public law that says they could have sued for this trust. This claim is based solely on the duty that arises out of this combination of contracts. And that is the duty we're trying to enforce. The only other comment I would make is that the attacks on what we're ultimately going to prove, both the plaintiffs and the judge of the Denver Probate Court, were in full agreement. This case needs to go to trial so that we have an opportunity to prove our claims. And that's all we've asked for. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Judge Hawthorne, going back to your question, at the very start of counsel's argument, you asked him to identify the duty which formed the basis of their action. I heard 15 minutes of discussion. Never once did I hear him identify the source of the duty that forms the basis of their action. He talks about proration and implied terms and so on and so forth. He never came out and identified the source of the duty. If it exists, it does not come from the trust agreements. It comes from somewhere else.
On that, I just wonder if you would just briefly address then the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. Why isn't that sort of part of the contract?
In the normal commercial context, a breach of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing gives rise to a claim for breach of contract. But in the insurance context, a breach of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing gives rise to a claim in tort. This is analogous to the insurance context. The whole purpose of the trust is to create insurance, health insurance, benefit insurance. It's like providing insurance. A breach of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in insurance context is a tort. Can I continue 30 seconds? Or I had?
Well, I think that concludes our argument. Thank you very much. Once again, the court thanks both counsel for their excellent arguments. It's a pleasure to hear such good arguments. This case, too, will be deemed...